Menopause lasts for just 24 hours. It's the days, months, and even years leading up to it that can profoundly affect your mind and body. Not willing to quietly grimace and bear the changes, Gen X is bringing about a refreshing reframing of what this time in your life can be like. Our Girlfriend's Guide, with advice from women who have been there, will help you manage, because you've got options and a whole lot more life, including this time of life, to enjoy. In a recent episode of the Michelle Obama podcast, the former First Lady recalled a hot flash she had on Marine One that left her looking like she'd just finished a 10K. Her guest, friend Sharon Malone, MD, a Washington, D.C.-based OBGYN and certified national menopause practitioner, brought up symptoms like insomnia, painful intercourse, screwy periods, and murderous rage. The word discharge was used. Such frank public discussion would have had Jackie O clutching her proverbial pearls. But thanks to boundary-pushing moments like this, people today are opening up about menopause unlike ever before, finding support and answers in each other. Communities of in-the-throes women, women-identifying people, and non-binary people are springing up online in forums like Facebook's Menopausing So Hard and the Peanut app, essentially Tinder for finding perimenopause buddies. "We're all spilling the tea right now," says Omasati Bernie Scott, 55, creator of the Black Girl's Guide to Surviving Menopause podcast and project, who remembers when her OBGYN first told her she was in perimenopause in her early 40s. "I was like, wait, para what?" I had certainly heard the word menopause before, but I had no sense that it was a spectrum. Now we're in an amazing cultural moment of clarity about menopause, including what it actually is. For example, many are surprised to learn that menopause technically refers to the day that marks 12 consecutive months with no period. Average U.S. age is 51, and that the remaining one-half to one-quarter of life is considered postmenopause. The symptoms we associate with this life stage often occur during what's called perimenopause, the 4 to 10 years before menstruation ceases, when estrogen and progesterone, the two sex hormones responsible for helping to achieve and maintain pregnancy, begin to rise and fall unevenly. This means that by age 40, you may already begin to experience these symptoms, and many may catch you off guard. That was the case for longtime style maven Stacey London, 52, who was blindsided at age 47 by a slew of nightmarish happenings, including hot flashes, heart palpitations, memory lapses, crippling anxiety, dry skin plus acne, and an evaporated libido. It took 2 years of confusion, fear, and visits to specialists with concerns about early onset Alzheimer's before she finally realized perimenopause was the culprit. Now CEO of State of Menopause, a company offering menopause-specific personal care, London is joining a chorus of those screaming from the rooftops to help build a sense of community around a long, isolating topic. That's excellent news for the approximately 1.3 million women joining Club Menopause annually. That includes Gen Xers like me, now firmly in Perry's sweet spot, and even cusp millennials. We're on the verge of finally canceling the inexplicable shame surrounding menopause and dishing the dirt with our friends, more so than with our doctors or partners, according to a survey of more than 6,000 women from online menopause clinic Geneve. There's a lot about menopause you may not know to expect, but there are ways to take control. Let us fill in the gaps with girlfriend-vetted, expert-verified intel and solutions. You might forget the word for fork. We have conversations where we take turns finishing each other's sentences, because we're constantly losing our own train of thought. Copywriter Carrie Roatman, 53, about her and entrepreneur best friend Carlin Nelson Wolf, 53, both from Clear Lake, Minnesota. The experts say while difficulty with word recall and other memory problems can feel frightening, several people interviewed for this article describe being scared about early onset dementia, they're common manifestations of undulating hormone levels because estrogen impacts brain functioning, says Elizabeth Poynor, MD, PhD, a gynecologic oncologist and advanced pelvic surgeon in Manhattan. Though early dementia is rare, women do have a greater lifetime risk than men for Alzheimer's, and this may be linked with menopausal loss of neuroprotective estrogen. Lifestyle tweaks, including vigorous exercise, it improves blood flow to the brain and produces a protein called BDNF that helps grow new nerve cells essential for learning and memory, may help safeguard future cognition. Quit smoking if you do and try the Mediterranean way of eating. Loads of produce, beans, whole grains, good-for-you fats, fermented dairy products, and small amounts of animal protein, which has been linked with reduced risk of dementia. The girlfriends say, Lasara Firefox Allen, 50, a substance abuse counselor and author in Ukiah, California, recalls trying to log into their bank account, a routine task, and having to verbally talk myself through every step of the process. Names flew out the window, as did nouns in general. For her part, London recalls struggling to remember everyday words like orange and fork. On the upside, these scares convinced her it was time to take control of her health. There's a moment when you assess what's going on with you physically and mentally, and you reignite your own agency, she says. Hot flashes, cold flashes, and maybe panic. Oh my. A few years ago, I was leading the 10 p.m. newscast when out of nowhere I was drenched and could hear my heartbeat in my ears. Minutes later, I was lying on the cold tile floor of the bathroom surrounded by several confused coworkers. Tamsin Fadal, 51, Emmy-winning New York City news anchor. The experts say, around 85% of us will experience hot flashes, making them one of the most common paramanifestations. Night sweats are just PM hot flashes. The meltdowns, which often include spin class-worthy sweating, facial flushing, and rapid heart rate, are thought to strike when decreased estrogen levels confuse the body's thermostat in the brain, tricking it into thinking you're overly warm. The hot flash, counterintuitively, is your system's way of cooling you down. Not to be confused with cold flashes, also caused by a discombobulated internal thermostat. Twisting the knife, a sense of impending doom can precede flashes, causing them to sometimes be confused with panic attacks. The sensations can be quite similar, explains my OBGYN, Seema Vantakkalam, MD, clinical assistant professor at Northwestern Medicine, Feinberg School of Medicine, and a partner of Northwestern Specialists for Women in Chicago. Hormone therapy, or HT, can extinguish 90 to 95% of hot flashes. So can some antidepressants and supplements like black cohosh and wild yam, both of which are thought to have hormone-mimicking effects on the body, though Malone says it's 50-50 whether supplements will work. The girlfriend says, Fadal found moderate relief with herbal supplements like maca root and black cohosh, but ultimately turned to HT, which eased the hot flashes and night sweats along with some brain fog and hormone-related anxiety and depression. Dressing in layers makes it easier to strip when the heat hits, and she also swears by a cooling neck fan that resembles old-school headphones, buying them for friends when they become flashers. She sent me one after we spoke for the story. Your period will play hide-and-seek. My cycle was right as rain ever since I got my first period in 1979 during Mr. Barnes' math class. At 40, it turned wonky doing this shortening, elongating thing. At 41, I found myself pregnant, and I ended up going through perimenopause with one child in college and another in daycare. Bernie Scott. The experts say, this is commonplace in perimenopause. The drop in estrogen isn't linear so much as it is, well, wonky, says Vantakkalam. Periods may seem like they're coming at the beginning and end of every month. Then maybe they'll be 6 weeks apart for a while, then you won't get one for 4 months. The next thing you know, you're Charlotte in, and just like that, getting a flash period in a white jumpsuit. Low-dose birth control can regulate these periods, or if taken continuously, prevent them altogether. It will also reduce the odds of any unplanned pregnancies, which Bernie Scott says her mother and aunts called change-of-life babies when she was little. The girlfriend says, for Julie Big Boy, 48, a website content creator and business owner from Alpine, California, wearing washable period panties worked for catching breakthrough spotting and surprise periods. She likes that they're more cost-effective and environmentally friendly than pads, plus they work great for occasional light bladder leakage and sweat. The guy in Edvard Munch's The Scream will be your spirit animal. One night, I just let loose on my husband, listing all the things I didn't like about him. We both just sat there afterwards, stunned. I couldn't understand what was happening. It was like a different person was processing my thoughts. Amanda Thebe, 51, Toronto-based certified personal trainer and author of Menopocalypse. The experts say, perimenopausal rage and depression and anxiety is real. Estrogen and progesterone impact the neurotransmitters in our brain, which affects our mood, says Poynter. In a study of 40,000 women conducted by telemedicine startup Evernow, 60% reported anxiety or depression during perimenopause or menopause. Insomnia doesn't help matters. Hormone changes and restful sleep often go together like water and laptops. Nor does a history of mental health issues, which can rear up as hormones yo-yo. In addition to low-dose antidepressants, treatment options include HT or low-dose birth control, therapy, mindfulness practices, regular exercise, and certain supplements. Poynter, a functional medicine expert, says magnesium glycinate, maca root, B-complex vitamins, and phytoestrogens may help. The girlfriend says, Chicago artist Anne Heinz, 52, says the mood swings she experienced in para were more intense than those she'd had during decades of living with bipolar disorder. In addition to angry outbursts and anxiety, Heinz says that as someone who never had biological kids, she also struggled coming to terms with what menopause represented, the bigger picture. We're such a youth-chasing culture, and the fact that it was the end of my fertile years hit me hard, she explains. I felt like an old hag, useless. She found fast relief from her mood swings with a low-dose antidepressant. It's a pain in your everything. My knees, my elbow, my hips, and ankles, it all hurt. When I'd get up in the morning, I'd have to roll over onto my side, slowly unfold myself, stand up, and get the cricks out. Firefox Allen. The experts say, welcome to the exciting world of menopausal joint pain, hormonal-induced aches that strike as a result of a reduction of estrogen levels. Estrogen is a steroid hormone with anti-inflammatory properties, so it makes sense that as levels fall, aches and pains emerge. Menopausal joint pain is commonly misdiagnosed as fibromyalgia or just chalked up to growing older and falling out of shape. But Fabian, the NAMS medical director and director of the Mayo Clinic Center for Women's Health, says that unlike those scenarios when a person with menopausal joint aches uses HT, their pain decreases. Do what you can to maintain a healthy weight. Excess weight can stress out joints. And exercise as movement increases, blood flows to joints and surrounding tissues to prevent stiffness, says Elizabeth Ward, MSRD, co-author of the Menopause Diet Plan. The girlfriend says, Gabriela Espinoza, 56, is a women's wellness coach, sexuality educator, menopause mentor, and longtime yoga instructor in Austin. She switched from vigorous yoga to a more restorative style when she was going through menopause and her joint pain flared up, and adds that yoga is also known to improve a slew of perimenopausal symptoms, including poor sleep, stress, depression, and fuzzy-mindedness. For Firefox Allen, the estrogen-progesterone-testosterone trio of HT largely eradicated the achy, persistent pain. Sex might lose its luster. My sexual desire and ability to become aroused felt like they had died. I thought, oh my God, is this it? I'm done? Espinoza. The experts say, falling estrogen and testosterone levels can sap sex drive, says Fabian. These slumps may be even more pronounced in people who experience an abrupt menopause caused by chemotherapy or surgical removal of the ovaries, which causes estrogen and testosterone to both quickly plummet. Not helping matters, it's hard to get in the mood when you're exhausted from fractured sleep, feeling anxious or depressed during the day, or panicked about your suddenly foggy memory. The humming estrogen levels of youth also helped everything stay lubed. As they decrease, the vagina and vulva, the skin on the outside of the vagina, become thinner, drier, and less stretchy. Poynter says small doses of vaginal estrogen via cream, ring, or tablet can hydrate dry tissues, ease burning and itchiness, and make penetrative sex less painful. And because it's very low dose and absorbed locally versus oral or patch forms of HT, which are absorbed systemically, almost all women can safely use it, including breast cancer survivors. However, if you have an estrogen-driven malignancy, check with your oncologist first, says Poynter. The girlfriends say, An estrogen patch resuscitated Espinosa's libido. For Firefox Allen, a combination of Life Flow by EstroCare, estrogen, wild yam cream, purported to have progesterone-like effects, and testosterone made a huge difference. After adding in the testosterone, I masturbated for the first time in months, Firefox Allen says. Once your spark reignites, your vagina will probably still need a moisture boost. For Espinosa, a combo of lubricants, vaginal moisturizers, and twice-weekly vaginal estrogen cream helped immensely. She also underwent a series of Femilif laser treatments, during which a vaginal probe stimulates collagen production and increases blood vessel formation using painless laser technology. Mona Lisa Touch is another type. After her third session, it was like magic, she says. It still takes longer to reach arousal, but once I do, lubrication is instant. Call in reinforcements. In Genev's Menopause Zeitgeist survey, 94% of respondents said they don't receive enough support to manage symptoms, and only 1 in 3 feels their partner fully gets it. 99% of respondents in another Genev survey of 2,500 working women experiencing menopause found that workplace menopause care benefits are unheard of. Be your own best advocate with these pointers. Be honest with family and friends. Genev co-founder and CEO Jill Angelo, 48, suggests spelling out exactly what you're feeling and what you need to loved ones. That way, when you're cranky after a night of no sleep or quicker to anger, they don't take it the wrong way. Speak up at work. Angelo, a former Microsoft executive, recommends talking about hormonal manifestations like you would any other health issue. Don't be afraid to inquire about later start times if that's something that enables you to be more productive when insomnia and night sweats are running you ragged. Ask HR if existing leave or time off policies can be used for managing menopause-related symptoms or if appointments with specialists are reimbursable. Seek out the right care. Feel like your doctor is blowing you off or is behind the times? Use the NAMS website's Find a Menopause Practitioner feature on menopause.org to locate a nearby provider who practices menopause management. Bernie Scott also encourages members of often marginalized groups such as BIPOC or LGBTQ+ and gender expansive individuals to seek out providers who understand that health disparities exist because of racism, sexism, homophobia, transphobia, and other forms of systemic oppression. Try blackdoctor247.com or visit the Gay and Lesbian Medical Association's website, glma.org. HT, true or false? The use of hormone therapy, the R has been dropped from HRT because we're not trying to replace what the ovaries make, we're just trying to manage symptoms, which requires far less. Says Stephanie S. Fabian, MD, Medical Director of the North American Menopause Society, or NAMS, has been one of the most debated pill, patch, cream, gel, spray, or vaginal ring, is approved by the FDA to treat many perimenopausal symptoms, but there are risks. Yet every medical expert interviewed for this story, as well as NAMS and the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, agree that for many women, the benefits of HT outweigh those risks. Here's a Just the Facts, Ma'am overview. HT is hands down dangerous. False. The dark shadow over HT dates to 2002, when findings from the Women's Health Initiative linked the use of HT with an elevated risk of heart disease, stroke, and breast cancer, rocking patients' worlds and doctors' prescribing practices. Usage plummeted from about 40% of postmenopausal women to about 4%. Researchers discovered that the study was seriously flawed, and for symptomatic women under age 60 who were within 10 years of their last period, the benefits typically outweigh the risks, Fabian says. HT offers significant symptom relief. True. The therapy extinguishes 90 to 95% of hot flashes while benefiting mood, sleep, and vaginal dryness, massively improving quality of life, and may offer long-term protection against heart disease and osteoporosis. HT is right for everyone. False. Those with a history of a hormone-dependent cancer, like breast, blood clots, heart attack, or liver disease should avoid HT. Other risks include spotting, breast tenderness, and blood clots. But for women like Malone, who told Michelle Obama that she took hormones during perimenopause, it can bring much-needed relief. If you still have your uterus, you'll need progesterone along with your estrogen patch, pill, ring, gel, or spray, to avoid an increase in endometrial uterine lining cancer risk. HT contains high levels of hormones. False. Malone says patients are often surprised to learn that HT contains lower doses of hormones than low-dose birth control pills, yet women aren't afraid of birth control pills, but they're afraid of HT. Our next article by Samantha Vincenti is titled, Building Bridges. Amid ongoing cultural clashes about whether it's really necessary to learn and to talk about race, it is. One Austin woman's faith-based program brings dialogue and racial reconciliation to communities around the world. I can say hard things really well with a smile, says Latasha Morrison, that high-wattage smile beaming at me as it did throughout an hours-long Zoom that flies by. A friend once told me, it's like you punch me in the face, but you're rubbing my back at the same time. Morrison's uncommon gift was put to the test in her new hometown of Austin, where she moved in 2012 from Atlanta. I have pictures of my godkids and family up in my office. Now I'm the only black person that works at this place, Morrison, who goes by Tasha, says of the church where she'd begun working. A white coworker would routinely walk into her office and her eyes falling to the cluster of photos exclaim, I just love little black boys. At first, Morrison thought, that is so weird, and let the comment pass. But after the third time, she turned to her coworker and said, imagine me coming into your office saying, I just love little white boys. What would you think? She said, oh my goodness. But she didn't get offended, so I asked her, have you ever worked with black people before? She's like, why do you ask? And I said, because I can tell you haven't. Nor had many of the white people Morrison met in her new community, people who often made well-meaning yet cringeworthy racial remarks or asked her unprompted, loaded questions about things like her hair and her political beliefs. It felt as if people had saved all their ask a black person questions for me, and they unloaded until it almost drove me insane, Morrison writes in her book, Be the Bridge, Pursuing God's Heart for Racial Reconciliation. There was, for example, the time she attended a Christian organization's baseball game for work, where a pair of white parents quickly pivoted from small talk to the topic of desegregation and then began asking questions about black conservatives. And the time a white woman sitting next to her in the stands told Morrison that many slaves in the South had actually been treated like family. In that moment, Morrison writes, she felt her heart racing, emotions all over the place. The cumulative weight of these experiences sparked an inner call to, as Morrison puts it, truth tell with grace. She began hosting an ongoing series of discussions with friends and coworkers. I asked them to explore their own family histories, the ways they might have been complicit in racism, Morrison recounts. Together we talked, laughed, cried, ate, and prayed. There were movie nights too, The Color Purple, Friday, Coming to America. Sometimes people didn't show up. Sometimes feelings got hurt, but they kept on meeting once a month. When unarmed teenager Michael Brown was killed by a police officer in Ferguson, Missouri in 2014, the members of the group told Morrison that their talks about race, cultural differences, and the painful white supremacist history of places like East Missouri had been invaluable in navigating the headline-making tumult. By 2015, Morrison's group was comprised of 10 black, white, and Asian American women. They sat in a circle and passed around an elephant figurine to take turns sharing. That same year, the organizers of the IF Gathering, a religious conference for women, invited Morrison to share her emerging vision for bridging divides, particularly between black and white Christian churches. Her first instinct was to say no. This is a predominantly white conference, Morrison says. You don't have a black girl up there to talk about race. I thought everybody is going to get mad at me. Convinced by her supporters, Morrison crafted a handout for attendees, writing down the words that best captured the movements of her group's journey together. The booklet, titled The Bridge to Racial Unity, was the curriculum of Be the Bridge, or BTB, the nonprofit she would go on to found in 2016 in its earliest form. On stage, she led a group meeting modeling for attendees what a circle of trust could look like and how healing could begin. The positive response was immediate and overwhelming. In lieu of a website, Morrison directed people to a new Facebook group to get involved. From the day of the conference to now, that group has grown from 69 members to 90,500. Today, there is at least one BTB group in every state and in several countries, including New Zealand. Morrison's commitment to working through painful truths and to leveraging the strength of pre-existing community connections are two principles that drive BTB. Though one doesn't have to believe in any higher power to benefit, the curriculum is rooted in concepts found in Morrison's Christian faith, such as lamentation and confession. Knowing how deeply segregated and politically fractured church communities are across the United States, Morrison based the program on core principles that could unite participants. "I wish that the church was the headlights in this conversation," she says, "but in a lot of the circumstances, they're the taillights. Jesus needs new PR." For Micah Smith, a devoted Christian, Morrison's framework struck a deep chord, one that some might wrongly assume couldn't exist in someone from his background. As a kid in Georgia, Smith was a passionate Civil War reenactor. The first article he ever wrote for his high school paper asserted what he believed was the truth at the time, that the Civil War wasn't even about slavery. College first introduced Smith to the idea that we all hold personal biases shaped by our experience, regardless of race. But it wasn't until the killing of Michael Brown and Eric Garner at the hands of police that he began to reconsider everything he thought he knew about history and the way Black Americans' lived experience might differ from his own. "Oftentimes it takes someone dying and suffering for us to have that spark," Smith admits. "I wish it didn't, but that seems to be the way that it goes." Realizing that he couldn't expect his few Black acquaintances to guide him through his many new questions, "I was a bit lost," he recalls. A Facebook post from author Jen Hatmaker, an early supporter of Morrison's work, alerted Smith to the very same 2015 IF Gathering presentation where Morrison first introduced BTB. "I remember downloading the guide and reading it as I tried to get my kids to fall asleep," he says. "I was crying in the hallway, being like, this is it, this is the thing." Here's the step-by-step conversation you can have that leads to growth within a community that's biblically based, he says. "I feel like we're trying to reconcile back to the way God wants us to be, solid humans." Smith has been a BTB educator since 2017, leading trainings and teaching a primer course called the Whiteness Intensive for new white members who, like him, never learned how to discuss race and racism, to say nothing of doing it with someone who didn't look like them. "When you get shushed as a kid for even bringing up that someone is Black, you learn, oh, I shouldn't talk about race," he says. "But it's a privilege to not have to think about race." In the first BTB student group that Smith co-led with a Black woman colleague at the Tennessee University where he works, the six Black students in the group shared the occasional slurs and frequent remarks that made them feel unwelcome on campus. Smith says that for him, it underscored what those students had long known, that often we're walking right next to each other in two parallel worlds that aren't overlapping. "It's amazing to me how you can live in the same small community and not really understand other people's stories," says Smith. "And when you start to, it changes the way you engage in the issues, because you're talking to real people and it becomes about another person instead of just my ideology." On a Tuesday afternoon last summer, I listened in on a BTB meeting of 9 women, 7 white, 2 Black, who zoomed from tidy homes and sparkling kitchens that would make Nancy Myers jealous. Led by Andrea Middleton, a Black BTB member, and Margot Yoder, a white woman she'd gotten to know through a mom's meetup program near Atlanta, the group trades podcast and book recommendations as doorbells ring, dogs bark, and ovens beep to preheat. When Middleton asks each member to share what brought them to BTB, Jenny and Lori tell me they'd started up their own racial reconciliation group in 2016, not really knowing each other at all other than as parents watching volleyball together. That experience informs their appreciation for the structured curriculum and extra support that BTB offers. Lori, the group's self-described pushbacker, came to be the bridge, kicking and screaming at her friend Middleton's behest. "While I'm trying to process trauma in real time, I was also assisting this group of people through their own questions, which sometimes felt like an enormous weight, as a Black woman," she explains. The 9 women talk for more than 2 hours, alternately supporting and gently challenging each other with questions. One member just joined a new Bible study and was already steeling herself for racial debates that might surface in her more conservative circles. They discuss what doing the right thing even means and how often people, women particularly, are taught to favor peacemaking over uncomfortable moments. Listen to their conversation. It's striking how rare it is to hear people encouraging productive, healthy conflict. Their exchange feels quietly revolutionary in a butterfly effect type of way. Aside from a shared certainty regarding the facts of American history, no single member claims to have all the answers because there's always something to learn from one another. Though there are likely dozens of apt biblical verses, I'm reminded of the quote famously attributed to spiritual teacher Ram Dass, "We're all just walking each other home." Or, as Morrison says, there's several ways to do this work of anti-racism. We're just doing our little part, our little way. How to start truth-telling with grace. Latasha Morrison recommends taking small, consistent steps within your local community with the understanding that true growth and change takes time. We do this work when there's a national headline and when there isn't, Morrison says. We're dealing with a centuries-old issue, so we prepare people. This isn't a sprint, it's a marathon. Here are a few ways to begin getting more comfortable discussing race and learning how racism affects us all. Number one, form a book club. There's no shortage of excellent novels and nonfiction by Black, Asian American, Latinx, and Indigenous authors. A book club is a fun social way to spark meaningful conversation, and some releases include guided questions in their back pages. If you're not sure where to start, must-read recommendations abound online. Or ask a librarian at your local library for a curated list. If they don't have one, you may inspire them to create it. Number two, educate yourself about whiteness and the history of race in America. Research the racial history of the town you live or grew up in, including the roles your ancestors may have played, to gain awareness and to examine history's lasting impact. Seek out books and podcasts on the topic, such as Seen on Radio's Seeing White audio series. Be the Bridge also offers educational resources, including its Primer Foundations and Introduction to Bridge Building. Number three, organize movie nights. Round up some snacks, invite some people into your backyard or living room, and screen a movie that centers on characters of another race. Sometimes if people see that it's an all-Black cast or a Black lead, they automatically label it as a Black movie, Morrison says. I like to ask, where does that thought come from? Let's explore that. Number four, connect with more people who don't look like you. Morrison suggests taking a mental inventory of how many people you're in proximity with who are of your same race, from your friends to your family doctor. Those are clues that you live in a homogeneous community, she says. Setting a long-term intention to meet a more diverse range of people creates the possibility of future cross-racial friendships. Exploring new playgrounds or churches, frequenting minority-owned businesses, and volunteering are just a few things to try. Number five, join or start a Be the Bridge group. Want to join a pre-existing group in your area? Request membership in the private Be the Bridge Facebook group to get started. When you feel ready to form a group of your own, made up of 6 to 12 multiracial acquaintances, per the program's design, head to BeTheBridge.com. Our next article is titled The Conversations. Listen and learn from these chats between experts who've never met and people who've known each other forever for how to nourish your relationships and make them stronger than ever. Fully connected. The people we surround ourselves with every day, whether they're family members, romantic partners, or neighbors, are the fabric of our lives. Here, several thoughtful visionaries talk to Oprah about how certain individuals have left a lasting impact. Nelson Mandela. Oprah went to South Africa in 2001 to visit Mandela and talk about overcoming hate. Oprah. Do you believe people are good at their core? Nelson. There is no doubt whatsoever, provided you are able to arouse the goodness inherent in every human. Those of us in the fight against apartheid changed many people who hated us because they discovered that we respected them. How can you respect people who oppress you? You must understand that individuals get caught up in the policy of their country. In prison, for instance, a warden or officer is not promoted if he doesn't follow the policy of the government, though he himself does not believe in that policy. So you can change someone who is only carrying out a policy since that person himself isn't the policy. Absolutely. When I went to jail, I was a trained lawyer, and when the wardens received letters of demands or summonses, they didn't have the resources to go to an attorney to help them. I would help them settle their cases. My colleagues and I did not want to speak to the apartheid rulers at all, but some of us did this type of work that brought us into contact with our oppressors. When blacks were forced to leave Johannesburg and go back to their homelands, a man would come to me and say, "Help me. I've lost my job, I have children in school, and I am now required to leave my home." As a lawyer, I would go to the top authorities and say, "Look, I'm approaching you as a human, and here is my problem. I have to rely on you." Invariably, the person would allow the man to look for a job. So I discovered even before I went to jail that apartheid was not run by people who were monolithic in their approach. Some of them didn't even believe in apartheid. If you sit down and talk to a person, it's easy to convince him that apartheid can never save a country and will lead to the slaughtering of innocent people, including his own people. So we changed the hardened apartheid rulers into people who could work with us because we exploited their good qualities. Maya Angelou. Oprah sat down with the poet in 2000 to share thoughts on the profound impact of chosen family. Oprah. So as we list all your achievements, the first black streetcar conductor, recipient of 70 honorary degrees, author of more than 30 books, is there anything you wanted to have on that list but didn't get a chance to do? Maya. Well, one of the things I wanted was to have a daughter. I have a son who is my heart. A wonderful young man, daring and loving and strong and kind. I wanted a daughter, so I have taken people's daughters. I have certainly taken you. I took my daughter-in-law because I know I'm a good mother. Do you know what your greatest gift to me is? No. It's that every one of us who considers ourselves to be your daughter or your son, we all think we're the most special. So when I'm sitting with someone else who says, "Oh, Auntie Maya," and they're acting like they're the favorite, I'm like, "Excuse you. I remember when Gail's mother passed and I spoke at her funeral, each of the sisters said, I thought I was her favorite." That's the gift a mother can give to make everyone feel like they are the special one. And you know you really are. Bono. In 2004, the U2 singer opened up about what being a father taught him. Oprah. What if your children taught you about yourself? Bono. I have very little memory of my childhood, so as I raise my kids, the memories come back. Like you're singing your baby a song and you don't know why you remember it, but you do. You don't even know the tune, but you sing it anyway and think, how am I singing this song? There's a theory that whatever stage your children are at, it reminds you of that stage of your own childhood. Has that been true? I certainly thought my 20s were turbulent, but I didn't realize that the real turbulence comes later in life when you get a chance, whether it's through your own children or others, to revisit what made you who you are. Oprah, and brought on your rage. Bono. I wrote a piece called Rage is Not a Great Reason to Do Anything, but It'll Do. It's a story of me learning to write songs as a kid. I remember the frustration of hearing a melody in my head but not being able to quite put it down. So you learn to rely on other people, the band, and you start thinking that's a weakness. But it's a strength to rely on others. Anthony Ray Hinton. Wrongfully imprisoned for nearly 30 years, Hinton opened up about finding light in his darkest years. Oprah. 3 years into your prison stay, you heard the man in the next cell crying, wailing and wailing. Anthony. He'd lost his mother. I'd lived next to him and never even known his name. I wasn't there to make friends. But I thought of his mother and my mother and how from an early age mine had taught me compassion. So I hollered through the wall, "Is something wrong over there?" At first he didn't answer. Then he told me his mom had passed. I said I was sorry. I told a corny joke and we laughed a little bit. The next morning I realized my voice was back and my sense of humor too. Oprah. On that night you realized you weren't the only man on death row. Anthony. I realized we were both still human. Tom Hanks. Hanks visited Oprah in 2001 and revealed how he learned the true meaning of love. Oprah, does the instability of your childhood have anything to do with why you've become a great family man? Tom, honestly, I married into a classic old world family structure in which people like to spend time with each other. That hadn't been part of my existence. In the 13 years Rita and I have been married, I've discovered there's no substitute for that. There's such an advantage to being involved in the day-to-day details. It's a marvelous fabric to exist in. Oprah, everyone wants to know, what is the magic you and Rita have? When you made that speech at the Golden Globes, every day I stand at a crossroad and I see nothing but love and acceptance in every direction. That was more important to many women than the fact that you'd won. Tom, I view my wife as my lover, and we have a bond that goes beyond words like wife or girlfriend or mother. For example, I was able to construct a number of things in Philadelphia, a movie he made in 1993, because of my relationship with Rita. The way my character felt about his lover is the way I feel about mine. The same was true when I played Forrest Gump, who loved Jenny. Without my connection with Rita, I don't know how I would have been able to connect with what Forrest was going through. Oprah, do you remember what you said about Rita after you won as best actor for Forrest Gump? Tom, I said that I have a woman who teaches me what love is every day. Maybe that sentiment is possible to fake, but for me, it's really true. What makes me different from others is that I verbalize this stuff. The Dalai Lama. Oprah headed to India in 2001 to discuss purpose with the spiritual leader. Oprah, what is our purpose here on earth? Dalai Lama, to help one another. Oprah, that's big. If we all understood that our sole purpose is to help others, wouldn't that change humanity? Dalai Lama, yes, an understanding that begins with changing our attitude. We must realize that it is best to focus on our oneness, to reemphasize what is the same about each of us rather than dwell on what is different. Yes, there are differences between us, but it doesn't make sense to emphasize that, because my future and yours is connected with everyone else's. When we focus on our individuality, humanity inevitably suffers. And once humanity suffers, each one of us will also suffer. For example, a few minutes ago, there was a fire alarm in this building. I responded immediately, not because this building is part of my body, but because I am here in it. That's why I have to take care of it. Similarly, whether we love humanity or not, we must realize that we are part of it. My future depends entirely on the future of humanity, and so I am compelled to take care of humanity. That is why being compassionate is actually in my own best interest. And a symptom of my own peace of mind is that I can share comfort with others around me. Our next article by Julia Barrick is titled, Hello, Is It Connection You're Looking For? Stephanie Cacioppo, PhD, is a neuroscientist devoted to exploring how and why we experience emotions, and in many ways, artist Michelle Ryle is dedicated to doing the same. In her new memoir, Wired for Love, Cacioppo makes the complex science behind how our brains process love and loss relatable by sharing her own story of finding and losing the love of her life, also a neuroscientist, but in the field of loneliness. Graphic designer Michelle Ryle's most recent book, Maybe This Will Help, is a visual memoir that also looks within, using simple graphics and different kinds of charts, bar graphs, Venn diagrams, timelines, to convey complex feelings such as those about loss and chronic pain. Recently, I got on the phone with both of them, they've never met, to talk about love and loneliness, and then asked Ryle to translate Cacioppo's revelations and advice into disarmingly honest illustrations. Connecting with them was a reminder that, well, actually making an effort to connect can lift you out of all kinds of uncomfortable emotional spaces. Listen in. Michelle, good morning. Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me? Stephanie, hello. Let me say how humbled I am to meet you both. It's really a great pleasure. Michelle, I love your work, your book, and your graphs, and you taught me how to overthink less, so thank you. Julia, I am so excited to have you both on the phone. In somewhat similar ways, your very different bodies of work help us understand emotions. Can you tell me about what drew you both to this effort to help us, the public, understand emotions? Stephanie. When I wrote my memoir, I really had two goals in mind: to share the science of my story, but also the story of my science and how emotions can help us be more resilient and thrive even in the face of our challenges. Emotions are not basic instincts. They are more sophisticated than that. We have evolved to feel emotions, but also to understand emotions in a deep, profound way. We are a social species. We need to look outward and to understand others. That's why I'm so thrilled and honored to be with you today, Michelle, because I think your work really speaks to that and how we can master our emotions and share them in a more sophisticated way with others. Michelle, I'm also very shy, by the way, and Dr. Cacioppo, I related to what you wrote in the introduction of your book about being private by nature. What I try to do in my work is draw attention to the things people don't realize they're thinking. In that sense, the overthinking is helpful in trying to relate to other people. Vulnerable sharing is the ultimate caring. Julia, you have both said you are shy people. What does it feel like to share yourself and your work? Michelle, I wrote my second book during the peak of COVID isolation, which almost tricked me into thinking no one would ever read it. That helped me be more vulnerable because there was just no one around. In the introduction to your memoir, Dr. Cacioppo, you write that the people you were closest to will be the most surprised by the book. When friends tell me that they read it, I'm like, oh my God, you read that? Stephanie, yeah, I can relate to that totally. It's easier to confide in strangers or the hairdresser than dear friends because you can avoid their judgments. I learned the hard way that this life is about sharing my insight and my learning with others. If I survived the ordeal of the passing of the love of my life, anyone could do it. I had to open up and forget about myself and just think about others and how my story could help. Michelle, I'm wondering if you have advice for me as a daughter about how to help my mom, who is very lonely. She lost her husband. They were together from ages 16 and 17 to 72 and 73. She lives alone. She doesn't have that many friends in the area. It's COVID. Stephanie. First, Michelle, so sorry to hear this. Second, the best thing you can do for your mom is to ask her for help. I know it sounds counterintuitive, right? Ask her for advice about your hairstyle, your career, your books. It can be anything. She will still see a sense of worth in her life if she can help you. You are her baby, and she needs to take care of you from an evolutionary viewpoint. Our brain evolved based on mutual aid and protection, and it's not about financial aid. It's about sharing experiences, sharing good times, and sometimes challenges and struggles together. Michelle, that's good. I don't do that. Thank you. Julia, Dr. Cacioppo, in reflection, has it been a bit of a silver lining to find that so many people need you and need your late husband, Dr. John Cacioppo's research at this moment in COVID? Stephanie, at first it was not, I have to be honest. I took his last name, so sometimes I receive emails from journalists to Dr. Cacioppo that were meant for John. At first, everyone I received just reminded me that he was gone. Then I did what we call cognitive behavioral therapy to myself. I tried to remember how he always had this huge smile when he received emails like these because he loved to share his science and his findings. When I share his knowledge and extend and expand our findings from when we collaborated together on the interventions to reduce loneliness, that was the silver lining. Yes, absolutely. I could see a sense of worth by keeping his spirit alive, but also in reinventing myself and finding my new sense of worth and how my little life can be helpful to so many. It was really hard to survive his passing, and when I see I have an opportunity to help others, I can say yes, it was worth it to survive the ordeal, and I'm grateful to you all for that. The right amount of worry. Michelle, I want to ask about catastrophizing, like anticipatory grief or anticipatory loneliness. Even worrying about the death of a loved one if they're sick, or about the anxiety of losing someone you love even if they aren't sick. Stephanie, catastrophizing is key in this kind of process. There is a psychological mechanism we call defensive pessimism. You prepare for the worst, but expect the best. It creates realistic expectations, and that's healthy. But if you are only catastrophizing, not also seeing the possible good, that could be damaging to your well-being, because then you go into the spiral of rumination, negative self-talk. Let's say you are ready to go for a run and it's really cold, like below freezing. Just be realistic and say, it's going to be cold, I'm going to try, and then try. And if you go out for 10 seconds, that's okay. At least you've tried. That really helps train your brain to be more objective rather than worrying about what hasn't happened yet. When it comes to loneliness, we have the choice to continue to feel lonely or not. Loneliness is a biological signal just like thirst. We never feel guilty to be thirsty, so why should we feel guilty to be lonely? We can embrace loneliness like we can embrace thirst, and then it's our choice to do something about it or not. To drink water when we are thirsty or not. Connect with others when we feel lonely or not. It's our responsibility to do something about it to help ourselves before we can help others. We could think about the acronym GRACE. Write a love letter to yourself today and be grateful for all the things you are doing for others and all the things you're going through. That will help you and others, like your mother, Michelle, to feel that it's about reciprocity. You have their back, but they have your back too. Even if they are older, even if they are in a different situation, they can still help you. We should have a moment for ourselves and go exercise, go for a walk, go for a run, just so we can refuel and re-energize ourselves and then help others. And that will help us feel less lonely and others feel less lonely as well. The cure for loneliness. Michelle. Something I am curious about is the difference between being antisocial and having social anxiety. Is it okay to be alone sometimes? Is it okay to want to be alone sometimes? During most parts of COVID isolation, I thought I would really love to move to an island off the coast of Washington State, like the San Juan Islands. I would love to be completely remote, and that would be such a beautiful life. I'd listen to beautiful music and learn to play the guitar, and I didn't see anyone in that vision. I love this idea of solitude, and I would tell that to people, and they'd say, no, you need to be around people. And I'm like, no, I don't. But do I? Stephanie. One thing you said in your book is that as an only child, sometimes you don't want to be with others. If you're like me, you learn as an only child to entertain yourself and you're by yourself. You had no choice, right? As an only child, I could have cried all day long because I was alone or made the best of it and created value for myself, stargazed for hours and hours. It's like survival mode. We did the most with the situation we had, so now we think, lockdown, I can manage that. But also, we do need others to survive, and that's what I learned in my journey. And really, my husband John taught me that I was happier with him. I thought I was self-sufficient, but I needed him. I needed him to survive, and we need others. Michelle. Social avoidance seems like it creates a cycle. Is that true? As an only child, I often feel like I don't want people around. Maybe I have a lower threshold for people's idiosyncrasies. I think about my dad, who could easily get so irritated by people. That created more loneliness for my mom. She and I both have social anxiety. Does this come from that loneliness? And does that social anxiety just build up if you don't practice doing the things you mentioned? Stephanie. Yeah. If you're with others, sometimes that loneliness can fire back at you, right? Clinicians in the early days of loneliness studies tried to find ways to prevent loneliness. They thought, oh, lonely people, let's put them all together and they will be less lonely. But there's a paradox of loneliness. Loneliness is this biological signal that tells us we need to approach others to survive and feel less lonely. But at the same time, our brain, when it's lonely, develops some tools to defend itself, to defend us. A vigilance that comes with isolation. A tall glass of happiness. Julia, can we store up positive experiences? Stephanie, the answer is yes, please. Have fun and share as much fun and good news with others as you can because you will need that when the time comes. And that's what I did with John. We created memories. We took photos and we traveled and we just had fun at home with our families. And it was all to build memories for me in the future. When you feel lonely, the best thing you can do is close your eyes, take a deep breath in, and then picture the last time you met your best friend and laugh out loud. That brings a smile to your face immediately. You just activated your mirror neuron system, your ability to anticipate and reflect the actions and feelings of another person. Julia. Dr. Cacioppo, are there certain people who are more sensitive to loneliness than others? Stephanie. People who suffered early trauma in their life or separation are at risk to be more sensitive to loneliness, but it doesn't mean that they cannot do anything about it. We have different pain thresholds, integral pain thresholds, and emotional pain thresholds, but we can learn how to train our brain and our mind like we train our body. There is hope, really, and the key solution to feel less pain is to stay socially hydrated. Grace will lift you out of loneliness. Cacioppo devised an acronym for 5 important practices to prevent loneliness in ourselves and others. G, gratitude. Every day, write down 5 things you truly appreciate. R, reciprocity. If you know somebody who is lonely, ask them to help you. Being shown respect, being depended upon, can give a lonely person a sense of worth and belonging that decreases feelings of isolation. A, altruism. Helping others, sharing your knowledge, feeling a sense of mission, all this will give you a feeling of self-expansion that is similar to what people experience when they're in a loving relationship. C, choice. Understand that even though it might not feel this way, being lonely is a decision. You can decide right now, yes, right now, if you want to feel lonely or happy. E, for enjoyment. This might sound like the most obvious advice imaginable, but try your hardest to have fun. Enjoy life. Sharing good news and good times with others helps increase positive emotions and reduce loneliness. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.